Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
Welcome, Masters of Modern. I'm your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, not Ben Bayman. This is Michael Grothy.
Hey, Masters of Modern fans.
So today we're recording an episode about awesome things. So recently, in the last year, Wizards released something called Challenger Decks. And those were decks made for Standard that replaced what used to be the event decks. And those were decks that were good for new players to pick up and then play in an FMM directly. When Wizards was making event decks, they also made a Modern-focused event deck. It was a black-white tokens deck, and it was kind of a failure of a project, partly because just the price point that those event decks were, both for Standard and Modern, were always so low that it was hard to get real good cards in those decks. But Wizards has kind of revisited this as a subject for Standard, and we're going to talk today a little bit about what that would look like if they revisited it for Modern. We're going to go through the price points and kind of what the values in all those cards. The other thing we're going to be talking about today is Michael Grothy has a long experience of playing Scapeshift decks. He currently hasn't been playing red-green Scapeshift, but he played every version of Rug, plus a little bit of that Bring the
Light. There was a period of time where blue-based Scapeshift decks were not very good, and I didn't really want to switch over to red-green, and Scapeshifts were very expensive, so I sold my Scapeshifts and used it to fund playing a different blue deck, which is Grixis Control, which is what I've been playing. But now that Scapeshifts are cheap, and they're kind of breaking back into the meta a little bit, I might pick some up.
So we'll talk about that as well. And to kind of get into who Michael is, he is one of the game designers at Kesco. He was also one of the community organizers for the Santa Monica area. He managed Heidi Ho, the store, that actually, surprisingly, when we started playing there, way more pros have come out of that store than I expected at the time.
Yeah. it's a good breeding ground for competitive Magic.
Like, when I started at Heidi Ho, it was their very first tournament. It was a legacy tournament where the two people that ran the store at the time brought literally pre-con decks to the tournament. Another guy had six demonic tutors in his deck, and then a sideboard that he would tutor with that was of 400 cards. And then I showed up with Affinity. And
so that's either a really good deck or a really bad deck.
It was really bad.
It's hard to say. Yeah. Six demonic tutors, 400 card sideboard that you're tutoring from. Yeah. Might be good, but...
another person had the Naya, like, if you play a 5-drop red, green, white elf card that you like trigger. Yeah, it was playing like...
You like draw an extra card on your upkeep.
It was like a 6-drop. Yeah, something like that. And he was playing like 5 of them as well. There are a lot of people that didn't understand the 4-card rule. I showed up with Affinity, and my friend showed up with
Legacy Affinity with Artifact Lands.
Yes.
And the whole 9 years.
Yes. Yeah. And my friend showed up with Legacy Miracles, and we like to describe it like if you ever watched Dragon Ball Z back in the day, and they would do like the martial arts tournament, and like all of these like regular humans would go to the tournament, and they'd be like, I'm like the best martial artist on TV, and then like Goku would show up and he like had destroyed actual planets in the last episode and they would fight each other, and it felt like that. So Heidi Ho has gone a long way from that moment to today, where Andrew Brown, who works at Wizards, Jules Robbins, who also works at Wizards, both Heidi Ho alum, and then Andrew Brown's whole kind of testing group all kind of came out of that. And now Michael Hughes, who top-aided a GP.
He just top-aided a GP with Fred Green Aldrazi. Yeah.
Is the current Michael Hughes. He's new Michael Hughes.
Yeah, I mean, he's now running the Magic there.
At Heidi Ho. So check out Heidi Ho Games. It's in Santa Monica. They just moved by the Santa Monica Promenade. So you have an understanding of what it's like for a new player to kind of sign up for Magic and start getting competitive.
I sold a lot of event decks. Challenger decks were a little bit after my time working at Heidi Ho. I had already started at Kess by that point, but you know, I'm still in touch with people who run the shop, and so I kind of know a little bit about how to sell those types of products and what new players are looking for and what retailers are looking for.
And right. And beyond that, we, you know, want to let you guys know, because now it's time for the shout outs and advertising, now that we told we're going to talk about, make sure to follow us on YouTube. So this video right now is being recorded on Facebook stream. If you joined it for the Facebook stream, you just got a bunch of intros twice because there was an audio problem halfway through the episode, which I'll get into a little bit more thoroughly in a second. But you can watch this with good audio and other visual content on our YouTube channel. We're also releasing a special interview we did over the weekend that Ben did. So like, Ben's not here now, but he has his own episode that he's releasing this week. And then we also are releasing our top 10 Demir cards on the podcast app. So you'll get multiple content this week, partly because last week we had an audio video quality issue. And so the video that's up there is low quality. And so we want to make
the legendary Demir top 10 podcast is coming out of the vault.
Right. Well, that's because last week's episode, which was a episode about the most influential cards from each standard set. It does standard sets affect modern.
I was in the chat.
Yeah, so that won't have audio release from last week, but we will have a podcast-only exclusive episode, and we'll have we had that YouTube exclusive video, and then we'll have two additional episodes this week, including this one. So there'll be two videos this week that all come out, and it'll be great. And then
I'm excited about this Ben interview, by the way.
Yeah,
because I know who he interviewed, and it's pretty exciting.
I think we can just tell the world. I think
we can. We you don't want to keep it secret anymore.
We're going to release it this week.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's Gavin Verhey.
Yeah.
Inventor of modern. He created the format. Works at Wizards. Yeah. He came down and played in a Highlander Roulette tournament, and they had a bunch of fun, and then Ben interviewed him about the creation of modern, and I haven't watched it, so I don't know else what they talk about, so check that out. It's going to be awesome on the YouTube channel this week. Make sure to subscribe, and we'll tweet it out everywhere, and you'll find us if you find us. Follow us on Twitter, at the MMCast. I'm at Kes Wiley. He doesn't really use it, but it's at Dudder, D-U-D-D-A-R-D.
There's two Ds. I couldn't get only one D.
You got double Ds on both Ds?
At the end.
So D-U-D-D-A-R-D-D.
No, D-U-D-A-R-D-D.
At that.
But I don't use Twitter much. If you want to find me but in the Masters of Modern
Facebook
group.
You can yell at him
group.
There. Yeah.
If you can find me in the Masters of Modern Facebook group, I'm active there. I check it regularly. Twitter is just like a content dump for me. Sure. I just like, that's where I find out what's going on in the world of magic and news and whatever.
All right, sweet. So beyond that, let's talk about the episode. So pre-con challenge deck. So I guess, what is a pre-con? I'm going to interview you a little bit.
Okay, so are we talking about what the challenger decks are?
What are pre-con challenger decks in general?
Like, well, I mean, because every pre-constructed deck that Wizard puts out has a different purpose. So there's like intro packs are, you know, a kid or an adult walks into the shop and they have never played Magic before, and they just, how do I get started? So the shop can, you know, teach this person using welcome decks, which are free that Wizards provides. And then after that, if they're like, okay, I kind of get this, then you can sell them an intro deck. And that just kind of has, you know, very basic stuff. Nowadays, they come with Planeswalkers. I believe they're called Planeswalker decks, but I'm an old-time shop guy, so I always call them intro decks. But so they have a Planeswalker in the front. It's not a very good Planeswalker. And basically, it's just getting used to the game, and you also get a Planeswalker, which is an exciting card type, even if it's not very good. The next level is a Deck Builder's Toolkit, which is not a pre-constructed deck, but it's just like a big bundle of cards. Now, you can soup up your intro deck using this big bundle of cards. You get a lot of cards for what you're paying. It's like $20, and you get like 200 commons plus 4 packs or something, so it's a pretty good deal, and a bunch of lands, so you can kind of build your own deck. Okay, now you're looking to go to FNM, is the next step.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have a product that bridged the gap between Deck Builder's Toolkit and FNM for a long time, but you were supposed to use your Deck Builder's Toolkitted Up intro pack. Wasn't that great, and you kind of needed to buy a lot of cards if you wanted to actually compete. But so the Challenger decks were designed by the new play design team, which Andrew Brown, who you mentioned, is on, as well as mm-hmm. Paul Cheon and Tom Ross and Melissa DeTora, and a lot of like pro Magic players have gone on to work in play design. So they know what's good, they know how to look at the standard metagame and figure out how to attack it from the angle that Wizards is looking to do it mm-hmm. for FNM players. And so the Challenger decks were, they were four of the top decks in the standard, and they just put out Wizards pre-constructed versions of them that had kind of a limited number of rares and mythics, not all four of necessarily, but they were a lot better than the event decks they had come out with previously for standard.
So yeah, so one way to kind of look at it, and it's going to be the one that most people are most focused on, is what were the prices of the cards in the deck before they came out with, and how much the SRP on that deck is. So a Challenger deck retails at $29.99 versus that event decks, which are $24.99, so it's a $5 price increase. But where event decks were often not even worth necessarily the cost of the pack.
Right, I remember when they were coming out, like, we would be able to sell them the way we were supposed to, where it's like, oh, you know, you're looking to level up a little bit, why don't you buy this and jump into FNM? Mm-hmm. But anybody who had looked at the deck list would know that, like, it was not really better than the deck they had already put together using an intro pack plus a handful of boosters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it usually had, like, a couple of good cards, but it was, like, nowhere close to anything that was good in standard. Like, it was just kind of just an upgraded intro deck, but not where it needed to be.
Right.
Like, people who would buy the event decks were like people who are looking for Hallowed Fountains, mm-hmm. and there was a Hallowed Fountain in there, plus enough, you know,
like Verdant Catacomb
to be worth it.
Verdant Catacomb was
back
in the day. Stoneforge Mystic was in an event deck back in the day. Actually, that's the most famous event deck probably out there, one of two, the other one being the modern one, just because they came out with an event deck that was released either around or after the ban announcement for Stoneforge Mystic being banned out of Modern.
Yeah, I think it was after, because they do the ban announcements right before a set comes out, and they did the ban announcement, and then when the set came out was when the event deck was going to come out.
Right.
It was like when, I don't know.
It was the core set, because it had the Fury sword, or the sword that makes someone a chroma.
Sword of Vengeance.
Sword of Vengeance.
And the 12 deck. Or something.
So Stoneforge Mystic was on that deck, so they made one conceit that Stoneforge Mystic was banned at all tournament level play unless you were playing exactly the list of cards that were in the event
deck. The entire 75. You couldn't modify it, which, as we said, those decks were not very good. But if somebody wanted a Stoneforge Mystic, was like a $10 card at the time, they might buy it because Stoneforge Mystic plus the rest of the cards added up to a little bit more than what you would pay.
When I started playing, I bought a lot of, for instance, the dual decks, because that's how I built my like backlog of collection, especially for Commander or other formats.
Yeah, I mean, the trick about the dual decks is like, because they all have new border, everything's reprinted with a new border, you get a lot of people who are confused about formats like Modern.
Yeah.
I mean, I ended up with, you know, running a shop, I ended up with a lot of people who were just getting into Modern who would have bought, you know, the Merfolk versus Elves dual deck or whatever, and they're playing like some elf card that's not legal in Modern, but it has a Modern border. Right. They just bought it 2 weeks ago. How is this not Modern? And so dual decks are cool for what they're for, but they can be risky for building up your collection.
I think dual decks were problematic as soon as Modern was invented.
Yeah.
Like, I got really into dual decks before Modern happened. So, like, I had, like, Gilliard versus Liana was one of the first ones I ever bought. And, like, it, like, definitely helped me build up some of those early collections. But as soon as Modern happened and their, like, main reasoning for the beginning of the Modern format was the card border, they became more problematic than they
were. Yeah, the dual decks are very good for casual players, though.
But even Commander decks have that same problem. But at least then it's like meant for an Eternal format.
Yes, this is a Commander deck. You are buying this for the purpose of playing Commander.
Right. So you know, one of the things that we were talking about was price. And the Challenger decks, though, raised the price. And instead of having cards that were generally worth a little bit less than that they were cost, was $90 before that on average.
So, right, yeah. The average of the four decks price at the time of release was $90 if you added up all the singles, including commons and uncommons, so you're getting into a little bit of dollars and cents here. But they also had, the red deck had a Chandra and a Hazoret and a Glorybringer, which are all like staple cards. They were worth like $20. Well, not Glorybringer, but the Chandra and Hazoret were worth like $20+.
I think 40,
Yeah.
Not at the time of release, but they've been up between 20 and 40 during their life cycle.
Yeah, and then the Vehicles deck just came with four Heart of Kirin, which was like a $20 card, just four of a mythic.
Right.
And so these decks really like kind of pushed the envelope of what they were willing to do in a pre-constructed deck. And the players loved it. I mean, the shop... Heidi Ho, I've talked, you know, I go there regularly still and play, and I talk to the people who are running it now, like, hey, how's it going? Like, I kind of miss working there a little bit, but obviously it's great to design games at KESS as well, but but yeah, so they sold a ton of them, and people are just like, there are people who are still buying them for value. They're like, I need a Chandra and a Hazoret because I'm building mono red, and I just am going to buy this because it's the easiest way to get those cards and cheaper. But there are also a lot of people who are looking to level up from about intro pack level into competitive play.
Right.
And they, and
when I started playing Magic, to be able to just buy a deck instead of being like, oh, I like had to find all of the pieces to Eldrazi Monument Elves, or like, I have this goblin list that doesn't do anything, is like, would have made that jump up just a little bit more.
Honestly, I played your Eldrazi Monument Elves deck in a standard tournament. You let me borrow it back in the day. I got totally crushed by Jund. They just like cascaded into a Maelstrom Pulse and killed two of my Arbor Elves or something. And I'm like, are we even playing the same game?
Yeah, no, that deck was good against the blue-white control decks because like Wrath of God is
bad against Jund
Eldrazi
every round, I think.
Jund was your problem. So you know, the other thing to talk towards is that, like, then they came out with the Modern Event deck. And this was a $75 retail versus the normal $25, so it was three times as expensive. And that deck inside of it had a value of around, you know, this is from a professor video where he did, is it worth it to buy the event deck back in the day, from Tulare Community College. He did, it was around $140 to $200. Like, bottom was $140 and $200 was there. So there was definitely a jump up.
It's better than what they had been doing with their pre-constructed decks previously. Like, the standard event decks were not really there. I mean, like working at the shop, we kind of felt bad when we would be like, yeah, you can just buy this and jump right into F&M. It's totally cool, because that's how you're supposed to market it. But the whole time we were kind of like,
right.
You can't really do that. You're going to lose really bad. But, you know, part of these pre-constructed decks is that they want it to be an entry point where you can open it up and play an F&M and not have an awful time. But also the purpose is to get you to upgrade it. Like, they don't want to give you a completed budget deck, right? They don't want to give you, like, for example, like, you know, they could give you for standard, say, the Paradoxical Outcome deck. Probably all the cards in that deck for standard are within the, you know, the $90 budget that they mm-hmm. kind of have. Maybe you're not playing Karn in the sideboard or something. But other than that, you're like, you're basically there.
Right.
But that's like, once you buy that deck, you're done. There's nowhere for you to go.
Right.
And so they're trying to give you not just a jumping off point for standard, but a way for you to kind of build on it in your own way. Mm-hmm. So you buy this red deck and you're like, wow, Chandra and Hazoret are great. I need to buy more of these cards. Mm-hmm. And you know, they built the deck in a way where like playing one of each actually made a little bit of sense, because they were like a little bit faster than the red decks that are in standard, which are playing more 4 and 5 drop Glorybringer Hazorets, and they were playing more 1 and 2 drops in the deck to kind of like, you know, not just build a bad version of what exists, but build kind of a different type of red deck that kind of got you on the path if you wanted to expand.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is like kind of an interesting thing when you look at how to build one of these decks. You don't want to make them optimal. You just want to make them good enough that people can play with them, but then direct people in the path to optimize them.
Right.
But they're different than, say, what pre-con decks are, which is more just like, here's an introduction on how to play Magic to play casually.
Right.
It is something that, like, especially in Modern, where decks are so much more about game plans and kind of accomplishing those game plans, especially decks that are affordable. Like,
yeah.
If you want to buy a deck that's just kind of like doing stuff and is going to react to what their opponent does and does a little bit of everything, those are the Juns and the Jeskais that are $1,000 to $3,000 decks,
yeah.
Where compared to like Hollowed One or Scapeshift, which we'll talk about in a second, where these are decks that are actually more affordable, but those decks have a very linear path. So like, you can't really play Scapeshift without multiple Valakuts, Primeval Titans, and Scapeshifts. Like,
yeah, your deck, I mean, is like Modern is a lot more linear. Like, the linchpins of the standard red deck are, say, Hazoret and Chandra and mm-hmm. Glorybringer, but you can build a good red deck, and they did, with one of each of those cards.
Right.
And in Modern, that's like, can be a little bit more difficult because the decks tend to be more linear.
Right. And I think that's kind of what they did with vehicles, is they realized there's a little bit more of a linearity. Like, we can put in bad vehicles here,
totally.
But you know what? Let's just tank this one card. We'll give 4 mythics to every person, but like, this deck now works versus without it, where it just wouldn't.
Yeah, and like, reprinting a card into standard is not, like, that's not really going to affect people's collection a lot in the way that, like, reprinting a Modern card like Scapeshift into standard is going to affect the price, because standard prices are fluctuating all the time. There's, like, always an impending rotation. I mean, standard is just so much more volatile mm-hmm. that, like, printing 3 Hardikirans into the format is not really going to break anybody's, you know.
Right. So now let's talk about the Modern Challenger decks that were, so today the rest of this episode is going to be spent kind of, not the rest of the episode, but for the next segment, we're going to be talking about how we would build Modern event decks. Like, what tools would we make pieces? What kind of philosophy do we think we want to belong to it? What price points we're aiming at, and then which archetypes we picked, and then some spicy picks we have for those archetypes.
Yeah, I mean, because if you look at the standard event deck list, they always tried to put in something that was like a little spicier. I have them, I brought them up, and I took notes and I left them upstairs before we came down to the episode. But
For the Modern event deck, which is a good one to point at, they have stuff like Zealous Prosecution. In their black, because it was a black white token list.
I think that's pretty standard in black white tokens, but
Shrine
I think
of
something
the Legion.
Like Elspeth Knight Errant as a one of, or like 2 Shrine of Loyal Legions. Like, these are cards that didn't quite make the cut in the deck,
mm-hmm.
but they're cheap-ish. I mean, Elspeth is a planeswalker, she's not super cheap, but
sure.
She's a card people like playing with. And these are ways that they can kind of like lead you on the path of kind of like making your own interesting decisions about deck building.
Mm-hmm. Interesting enough, the paper version of this deck is still $174.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's like held its value for the $75.
Yeah, and there's like no shocks or fetches or anything like that. It's just straight up
the big things that you just held on to that ended up being worth something were Inquisition of Kozilek and Path to Exile.
Yeah.
Like, Path has just, they could reprint it forever, but it's still the most important removal spell in the format. And then there's like Sword of Feast and Famines in the deck, and that's still $34 because
Sword of Feast and Famine is just one of the probably all-time favorite cards of a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's a commander one for sure. Although when it shows up in Modern, it always gets my attention, which is the reason I put it in the deck, because you're like, oh, I get to play with this? It basically says take an extra turn on it.
And the fact that like we're now in a world where Abrupt Decay isn't the top four most played removal spells in the format makes it a lot more viable than it used to be.
Definitely.
Call Against Command exists, but Kalman's, you're at least getting not one for one because they get whatever the second effect they pick, but at least your mana cost is the same as what it is.
Well, you had to pay to equip, so not really. But the way that Sword of Feast and Famine usually plays out is you like wait until your opponent is tapped out and you're probably like a blue tempo deck, like a Delver or like a Fairies or something.
Right.
And you are able to like tap out to play the sword and equip, hit them while they're not expecting it, and then you untap all your lands.
And then
you have Counter Magic, you have Restoration Angel, you have like a million things up, and they discarded a card, and they're like, oh, I guess Colligan's Command, and you're like, haha, Remand, gotcha.
I wouldn't be surprised also, and I'd have to, I guess I can click on it and actually look. I wouldn't be surprised if this recently bounced up a little bit. It did bounce up a little bit and then went down again because of the Stoneforge Mystic speculation.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Because
Stoneforge, I don't think that would be the premier sword, but it would be one people had their eye
on. It's the second place one. I mean, it's Batterskull for sure, but then
I'd put War and Peace above it, I think.
They're close for what you just described. Like Stoneforge Mystic's game plan of like play it early and then you can just keep mana up forever is better with Sword of Feast of Famine than it is with Fire and Ice.
It's better in like a Cobblade, Esper Stoneblade type deck, yeah. But so like the spicy stuff they put in the standard decks, they put like they did a blue-white Approach of the Second Sun deck, which is like was the premier control deck in standard at the time, and still kind of sees play, although some of the people are just cutting the approaches and using Teferi putting himself back into your own deck so you don't deck out before your opponent as their wincon, which is pretty unpleasant. But but at the time, Teferi hadn't been printed when they made these decks. So Kefnet the Mindful, there's one in the main, one in the board. There's one Farm to Market and four Aether Meltdown, which are like both removal spells that kind of show up in standard because you have to get a little creative with blue-white removal spells. You can't just play four path.
Right.
It's the same way that people play like Condemn in Modern if they're looking for a fifth white removal spell in a control deck because like your options are kind of limited. So it's playing like a few of these like kind of spicier cards to get you thinking about the deck and not just straightforward, here's the Approach of the Second Sun deck that top eighted the Pro Tour minus all the expensive cards, right? Like,
well, that's like, when we were building this list the entire time, I was like, oh man, if Chalice wasn't like a $80 card that to play four of them would just max out our budget, it would be really good for this because Chalice decks play really off the wall removal spells. They play stuff like Journey to Nowhere because they can't play Bolt or Path or Fatal Push because Chalice turns it off.
Yeah, it kind of forces you to get creative.
But Chalice itself is so expensive that those decks are the one that all works. So back to my notes so I can read what we're supposed to be talking about next because that's the power of what we're doing. So the first thing we did, and kind of it was is a combination of, A, we just thought we kind of needed to raise the price point, similar to how they raised the price point from $25 to $30 for the Challenger decks in standard.
Yeah, I mean, Modern is just much more expensive.
We wanted to make sure we kind of did something comparable. And the other thing is, when you look at it, before it was three times. So a Challenger deck was $25.
It was $30. Challenger decks are $30.
Challenger deck of $30. Event decks were $25 and the Modern event decks was $75. So that's three times. That's three times as expensive as a Challenger deck.
Sure. Yeah. I misunderstood. I thought you were talking about card value.
Yeah, we have the next step. Yeah. You're ahead of me.
I'm ready for the next
step. So back to what we're talking about. Event decks, $25. Challenger decks, $30. Event deck, $25. Modern event deck, $75. Three times that. So we're Challenger deck, $30 times three is 90. And we rounded that up to 100 mostly because we just felt like it and it made our lives a lot easier. And so then if you look at what the value is in a Challenger deck, it's around $90. So it's three times expensive on top of that of what a Challenger deck is.
And Wizards always says that they don't, you know, they acknowledge the collectability of the cards, but they don't actually acknowledge the distinct secondary market. I don't know exactly how true that is because if you look on release, the values of the Challenger decks, they're all very close to $90. So it seems like if they weren't just like going on TCG Player with a budget, they were doing something similar because it's pretty close for all of them.
And so when we were looking at it, we were okay, multiply it by three because that's what they did. So that keeps us in the same grand, and that gives us $300. And with $300, you can get pretty close with a few different archetypes, and something that we're going to throw to you guys, people listening now in the future or watching, to go to the Facebook group. So now we're back to shout outs before we get to what
group,
this is.
Facebook group, YouTube comments, tweet us.
everywhere you can find us, which, you know, pretty much at the MMCast or website name / the MMCast, you'll get to us. Tell us what list you think. Come up with you have a modern deck list, it needs to be competitive, and you have $300 to spend.
Right, and we're not looking for something that's like
including
a budget
sideboard
deck, right? Yeah. Because this is something that you would want somebody to buy and go to FNM and be like, after playing this deck, I really thought of a great way to upgrade
right.
it.
Because like, yeah. I can look at MTG Goldfish right now and look through, they have like an entire section of modern decks that are like under $150 or $100, and those... Right. are fine, but we're looking at something like, can you build a competitive modern deck for under $300?
Right.
And that includes substituting things. Like, the mana base is one of the easiest places to start looking at ways to make things less expensive.
Right.
And then on top of that, you know, we think this is a space where you don't need four of us. Like, for instance, we're going to talk about Hollow One decks, and we cut down to less blood gas because all four makes it so that when you buy the deck, you don't have to find more of them.
And obviously it impacts our budget.
Right.
So it's kind of a win-win to cut a blood gas, since that's not a totally essential card. Would we ever cut, like, you know, we wouldn't cut like a Hollow One from mm-hmm. the Hollow One deck, or like
Correct.
A Gurmag Angler, but something like Blood Ghast, where it's like a little more expensive and it's not necessarily
a key feature of the deck.
Yeah,
right. Like the if you have something that's like really expensive, play four of them. But if you
yeah.
have something that you're like, this is a little bit more of an expensive card, it gives people an onus to collect.
And it's in the deck, so you can see what it does.
Right.
You're like, wow, Blood Ghast is actually really great here, and I need to pick up another one.
Right. And some of what we did here is also, you know, we now know that we're returning to Ravnica. Returning to Ravnica in the fall and all of next year, and there is a safe assumption that some amount of Shocklands will be reprinted. That might be not true, but I'm making a guess.
Is some amount 10? Do
yeah.
you think they're going to print 10?
Exactly 10 of them.
That's a good number.
But not like multiples of the 10. There will be only 10 in all packs in the world. So you can get one Hollowed Fountain.
It seems bad.
It's like, so yeah, we think
Super
Sharks are being reprinted. Super
expeditions.
But so those are being printed, maybe. We don't have no confirmation, but we're predicting that here. And so we were a little bit looser with those in our budget. I mean, to be totally honest, we're printing them into the ground here. I mean, not totally, but there are some decks here, specifically the Red Green Shapeshift one we'll talk about, that we're playing four, because you need to play four and there's no way around it, and we're fine with that.
I mean, at the time of Return to Ravnica, the Shocks were printed into the ground. I mean,
yeah.
most of them were like $7.
Yeah, which is fine. Which is where they should be. So let's get into the deck list. You ready? Which one
yeah.
are you going to start with?
Let's do Scapeshift last. That'll
okay.
segue into our Scapeshift
cool.
conversation if we want.
So let's start with the one that is
we're
the
talking
most...
about Hollow One, right?
Yeah, let's
just keep talking
okay.
about Hollow One.
All right. Blackbeard Hollow One. It's actually not that expensive. I like looked at it. The most expensive
yeah.
part of it are like the lands and then like Goblin Game. Not Goblin
lore.
Game.
Goblin lore. Yeah.
Which like is a card that A, should not be as expensive as it is. But B, we also made the conceit and only printed two and printed two Cathodic Reunions in our list. Bring
so
it up.
At, we'll...
We'll post the list on... I'm going to post the list right now on Facebook.
And Goblin Lore is definitely a card that's, like, on Wizards Radar to reprint in, like, a Modern Masters set. I mean, if we're lucky, it'll be in a Commander deck, although maybe that would be bad because then you run into the problem where everybody buys one of the Commander decks because it has Goblin Lore in it.
Yeah.
But they'll reprint Goblin Lore somewhere, like a Battle Bond type thing or something goofy like that. But,
right.
But that's... We don't think that if they did... Challenger decks for Modern right now, that there would just be like four Goblin Lore. So that would be one of the places where you have room to upgrade.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. It's like a very obvious card you want more of. And there were a surprising lot of things that you could play kind of instead of that. And one of them was Cathodic Reunion.
Is this link on the stream?
Yeah, I just posted the link to
the list. Wow, that's really cool. Okay, cool.
Yeah, you can. If you're on the Facebook stream right now, you can see the list. We will be recommending people.
I was wondering how we were going to post these lists. I didn't realize you could just do that. That's
yeah,
cool.
Okay. I have the power of... Oh, it's not on the screen of here.
Oh, got it. Okay.
It's in the comments.
Still cool.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, there's a lot of staples in this deck that are really cheap. Flamewake Phoenix is really easy to include as a 4 of.
Yeah.
Flameblade Adept. Street Wraith, Gurmag Angler. In our list, we
and
cut down
the one.
And I would
say that those are all like very essential pieces of
yeah.
the deck.
We cut down
you
on one Tapper.
You would never play Hollow One without four Street Wraiths.
Right, right.
Or four Flameblade Adepts, because you need that one drop.
Correct. We did include one Bloodstained Mire, partly just to kind of inform people that you should be picking up more of them. The deck needs them.
Yeah, because of Delve, like, it's pretty crucial to be putting
doing a more of a shock mana based thing. Yeah, and we, you know, we kind of hinted that this was something you should maybe do without fully jumping into it. Included one Collective Brutality. That's another expensive card the deck normally plays two. I think you can get by with one and then play with other alternatives. Yeah. Our spiciest includes, and it kind of is what's replacing Collective Brutality, are Lightning Axe and Conflagrate.
Yeah, I mean, they're also a cheap removal spell like Collective Brutality. They allow you to discard like Collective Brutality because that's a deck where, like, you very consistently on turn 1, 2, 3 need to be discarding a lot of cards.
Right.
Conflagrate is more of a late game option, but it's cool. I mean, it's good in a lot of matchups where you're going to need to deal with multiple creatures.
Right.
Elves or other Collected Company decks. I mean, Dredge was playing Conflagrate for a long time.
Yeah, I think it still is.
Probably.
Yeah. And my like, the fact that you can just burn your opponent out if you're like, oh man, I need to do 3 more damage, just boom.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's Black Red Hollow One. The next deck we're going to talk about is Blue White Spirits. So this is a deck that's more powerful now because of M19. And kind of one of the big value cards we decided to reprint here, because it is the one deck that needs value more than other ones, like for the most part this deck is actually relatively inexpensive to build, was we did add a Cavern of Souls.
Well, and so, you know, when we were building this, we were talking about the way that people typically build Spirits decks, and because you are playing like a bunch of 3-drops, like a lot of the notable Spirits in Modern, guys, St. Traff, Spellqueller, you know, Drogskull Captain are all 3-mana cards. A lot of times these decks are playing Noble Hierarch or Aether Vial,
right,
which are both kind of out of our price range.
Correct.
For these decks, because if you're playing Aether Vials or Noble Hierarchs, it seems kind of silly to not play 4 in a deck like this. Mm-hmm. So,
and there's a way to take this kind of towards a Bant color thing, and we did discuss that. We were resistant to really build a mana base that focused on that in this format because of the fact that we don't have fetch lands. Mike flipped over. Because we don't have fetch lands really available to us, because we don't have the ability to build like full-on 3-color mana bases that felt safe, especially in a format where you will be playing against Blood Moon, creating a deck list that felt a little bit more along the lines of a 2-colored, like, felt safer.
And what's nice about there being 2 different builds of Spirits, there being like an Aether Vial build and like a green build with Noble Hierarch and Collected Company, it means that like You have a choice when you play this deck. Mm-hmm. You know, you buy this deck, you play it at FNM, you're like, I could really use some acceleration, let me look at what's out there. Mm-hmm. And Noble Hierarch and Aether Vial are 2 different paths that you can kind of experiment with, which is the point of these decks, is it's supposed to be something that you can build on and you can kind of, you know, make into something greater than what comes in the box.
And some of the key cards, like we have 4 Mausoleum Wanderers, we have 4 Rattle Chains, we have 4 Drogskull Captains, we have 4 Supreme Phantoms, which is the new lord. But then, you know, we get a little bit spicier. There's only 3 Selfless Spirits, but that's obviously a key card of the deck that you can realize you need to pick up more of. 3 Spell Quellers, which is another card that's definitely something they're like, this card was really good. How do I get my 4th one? So you have a little bit of that kind of play. And then we have like the fun ones like Remorseful Cleric, which we obviously in the sideboard are maxing out on, but like in the main deck it's spicy.
Is also a card that I think is like, I mean, I'm not an expert on Blue-White Spirits, so don't rip me up in the comments, but I feel like Selfless Spirit is like kind of a meta call. I mean, it's good right now because everybody's playing Wrath of God and Anger of the Gods and everything because you have to beat humans. Right. But like, you know, by giving somebody only 3 Selfless Spirits, it lets them know that like this is a card that is good in the deck, but you are not necessarily needing to max out on it, but it's meta dependent, and you're always going to want to modify your deck based on the metagame, especially in Modern.
And the key cards of this deck like really are Mausoleum Wanderer, Rattle Chains, and Spell Queller and Dragskull Captain, and everything else in it is just kind of the supplement that plan.
And you said Supreme Phantom, right?
Yeah, it's Supreme Phantom.
Okay, because that's a new key card for the Spirits deck. Correct. I mean, I think that's the reason that in right now, today, if you were building a Spirits deck, you're probably doing it because they just printed Supreme Phantom, and that's a great card.
You're not into Remorseful Cleric? You don't want to exile some graveyards?
That is a great card for Modern also.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make me want to build a Spirit deck as much as maybe like a Court of Calling deck or something.
And then the sideboard, you know, we put some Dispels in there, a Geist of St. Traft, because why not? It's a Spirit and it's the best.
Well, I mean, I think it's an okay sideboard card. If you're, like a lot of matchups, it just wins, but it can be kind of clunky to be playing a 2-2 for 3 if they're playing Hollow Ones.
Especially when all the things you're doing are bigger than that. You have Kitaki, which is a Spirit. You have more Remorseful Clerics. Eidolon of Rhetoric is also a Spirit for your Storm matchup. So there's a lot of little pieces in there that you can get to be able to kind of build a deck off of. of that.
And you mentioned the Cavern of Souls, right? Oh, yes. We were saying that's the big value card. Yep. Cavern of Souls, yep. And that's also to kind of replace Aether Vial as like a way for your creatures to not get countered.
Right.
Because... you know, because you're playing more expensive creatures, you're more likely to be running into counter magic.
And I have Fairy Conclave instead of like some like as a man land that's thrown in there instead of a Hollow Fountain like or a Mutavault. That kind of plays in that space as well because you just want
but
some type of flying attack.
That's a good card in a deck like this.
Right. Moorland Haunt is a spicy include.
Do Blue White Spirits decks not play
I don't
that?
Think they play it.
That's a great card.
Yeah.
They make spirits.
Yeah.
They get pumped by all your stuff.
Yeah. All right. Next card. I think most of them don't play because it's either three colors. Decks where you like you don't really
that's
have
true.
The room in the
that's
database.
True. You can't play a colorless land.
Yeah.
The Aether Vial decks are probably playing it though. Right?
Yeah, I can maybe see it. Those are newer anyways because they just got all the new pieces.
That's true. Yeah. You probably were not only going to play two colors before Supreme Phantom, but Supreme Phantom allows the deck to be a little bit faster.
Correct. So second to last, we got Black Widow Eldrazi. So this is actually the closest to a list we literally just found online. Like, we made pretty minimal modifications.
Yeah, it's kind of a cheap deck.
Mostly it was in the mana base, and we just kind of brought the mana base down. And the other one is the deck ran four Aether Vials, and we brought it down to two Aether Vials just because we can't afford it under our $300 budget here,
and
included two Mind Stones.
I think that Aether Vial is, like, more of a hallmark of this deck versus Blue-White Spirits because...
It's playing the Leonin Arbiter getcha plan.
Right. You're, like, you're sacrificing your lands to be Ghost Quarters or your... You need to be like deploying disruptive threats quickly. You're playing mm-hmm. more like a Death and Taxes style.
Correct.
Then whereas Spirits, which is kind of just like, I need a little bit of acceleration and I don't want to play green.
Right. And the power level of a card like Flicker Wisp specifically is significantly higher at instant speed versus sorcery speed to the point where it's almost not a card if you're playing it at sorcery speed.
And like,
if you are playing it at instant speed, it does something.
You know, if you're playing a deck like Black White Eldrazi, it's because you want to put Tide Hollow Sculler in on their draw step
right.
with an Aether Vial. That's the reason you're playing the deck,
correct.
Because you think that's dope.
And that's what this deck does. You know, it's playing Restoration Angel, and it's playing Eldrazi Displacer to be able to do that kind of off of the Aether Vial. So it gives you other options to be able to do that with. All of your other things, Wasteland Stranger, Thought Knot Seer, Blade Splicer, Tide Hollow Sculler, are all ETB effects. And then you're just playing a Thalia, Leonin Arbiter package on the front end to kind of keep you up ahead on mana and to be able to lock your opponent out with all the paths you're playing, because you want to be exiling their stuff.
Right, and you're able to take cards out of their hand. So once you've seen their hand with Tide Hollow Sculler on turn two, you take something, you're playing a Thalia on turn three, you're playing Thought Knot Seer on turn four. Now at this point, whatever they're left with, they probably can't even cast.
Right.
Maybe you've destroyed one of their lands at some point.
Yeah.
I mean...
sorry, I'm posting the list so people can see it.
Yep, that's important.
Precon.
Everybody follow along.
Cool. I think this deck like came out pretty solid and is just kind of a deck that
exists. What's the spiciness in here?
The spiciness isn't here. I would go with we're playing a Warping Whale.
All right.
Which is pretty spicy. There's some in the sideboard.
And it's a good card. It does a lot. I mean, countering a sorcery is something that like people are not generally going to be playing around, and you'll get them.
Mm-hmm. The other card is Mind Stone. So Mind Stone, because we had to cut down the Aether Vials, we needed something else to kind of compete in that space, and Mind Stone allows you to ramp to your four drops while also sacking it for value when you no longer need it in the late game.
Yeah, I mean, getting turn three Thought Knot is, I suppose, the other good reason to play Black White Eldrazi,
right.
although you can do that in Eldrazi Tron as well, but turn three Thought Knot is just like such a beating against mid-range
most
decks
people,
because they're
going
to have problems with the 4-4, and they're going to have a lot more problems with the 4-4 if you take their turn
right. Right. The one of the weirder value things is we're playing one Evolving Wilds just because we're playing with Wastes, Swamps, and Plains and being able to get that waste if you need it, but really fix your mana. It's definitely worse, and you would not do this if you were building this deck past this, but just like as a conceit to price and fetch needs. So that's the last of those before we get into the big one that I think is my favorite one, which is, and also the second half of our episode, Red-Green Scapeshift. This deck is also, with the reprinting of the cards that were reprinted, become much more affordable.
Cards that were reprinted being Scapeshift?
Yeah. Valakut is now the most expensive card in the set, and it's still like under 20 in the deck. Sorry.
Yeah.
In the deck, and it's under 20. Primeval Titan has basically been printed into the ground. Blood-Braided Elf has come back up, but it's still not worth
People aren't playing it a ton in modern, and it's an uncommon that's been printed a ton.
Right. They're like, all cards get a hand up. This is the one deck where we did max out on Stomping Grounds. So we maxed out on four Stomping Grounds, four Sheltered Thicket, and four Cinderglade to get maximum Mountain Forest.
Because the Titan Shift deck, which is the version of Scape Shift that we built here, is effectively a green deck, except that you have to be playing a ton of mountains.
Correct.
So if your mountains tap for green, that's exactly what you need.
Right. And with that alongside that, there is a level of just good red cards. You play like Lightning Bolt and Sweltering Suns, which is actually
keep you alive until you can get seven mana.
Correct.
Yeah.
But you know, talking about some of the spicy cards, Courser of Crucifix and Reclamation Sage are my big two spicy. Not Reclamation Sage.
Yeah, Reclamation Sage I think is pretty standard.
Tileless Tracker.
You can't lose to turn three Blood Moon out of Mardu Pyromancer or whatever. You gotta be able to Summoner's Pact for that Reclamation.
Most cards that wreck you game one or in game two or three, Reclamation Sage is very helpful to have in your deck. And because you have tutor targets for it,
we have the two Summoner's Pact because it's a pretty essential part of the deck, and they're not too pricey.
Yeah. They're not, they're like $4.
But there's what's the spice? It's Courser of Crucifix
and Tireless Tracker.
We got a Tireless Tracker in the main.
Got a landfall package. Because you're ramping so much that every single ramp spell you have, you know, you're playing Farseek, you're playing Search for Tomorrow, and you're playing, obviously, Scapeshift. And all of those cards, and Sacra Tribalder, and all of them just get you extra triggers on those two cards that can be threats on their own.
Yeah, I was discussing, actually, Titan Shift sideboard with a buddy recently because he was thinking about putting the deck together, and he knew I played Scapeshift, so he was asking me about it. And I was saying that, like, with the red-green version, like, sideboarding can be kind of tough because, like, you have to dedicate a lot of slots to any card you actually want to draw, because you don't have any card draw in the deck. You're just ramping and playing Primeval Titans. And you have the Summoner's Pact to tutor for creatures, but a lot of times you need, like, an answer to a Blood Moon or something. And people are playing Torpor Orb from humans now, so maybe you need, your Reclamation Sage won't even do it anymore,
right,
or something.
Right.
And so you want, like, Tireless Tracker in the main gives you a way to, like, beat a Blood Moon because you can make Tireless Tracker big, mm-hmm. and, like, when you play Primeval Titan, instead of hitting them, you're, like, drawing cards. You're drawing up to your Nature's Claim where you can, like, kill them.
It gives you a lot of different versatility in the deck that Blood Raid also offered. One of the new things that they started doing was just playing Blood Raid, because Blood Raid is just good.
Yeah,
whatever their opponent's
doing.
Right.
It'll attack if you are the aggressor in the mm-hmm. matchup, and it'll block if you're not, and it'll ramp you, or it'll get a Lightning Bolt.
Right,
or...
right. Okay, so that is it for the decks. Those are our four. Black, white, Eldrazi, blue, white, Spirits, red, green, Scapeshift,
and Titan Shift. Titan Shift specifically.
Yeah, red, green, Titan Shift specifically, and black, red, hollow.
So wait, one thing I think that is worth noting is we're on three Primeval Titan and three Scapeshift in the deck.
Yes, and two Valka, which used to be what people played. Now, new Scapeshift decks have been on to four, but as we mentioned,
yeah, which is somewhat a concession to budget, but it's the reason that we included, you know, there's one Thrag Tusk and the one Tireless Tracker and the one Courser, is it gives you, well, the Courser gives you a little bit of deck velocity. You can play the top card off of your library, drawing closer to the Primeval Titans that you need to win.
Correct.
And then the Tireless Tracker and the Thrag Tusk are just kind of like, we can't afford to play four Scapeshift for Primeval Titan because we're trying to keep this at a reasonable level budget-wise, you know, because if we're wizards, we don't want to flood the market with these mythics or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some alternate threats in the deck. Of course, they're not being a threat, but being more a card velocity engine so that you can get
it protects you, gets you to the late game because it A, gains you life, and blocks
and allows you to play the lands off the top of your deck, drawing closer to your big threats.
Right. So it kind of building velocity engines into the deck, and also
So when we're building these decks, we think it's important to make sure that
we're covering the weaknesses we're creating.
Right, we're creating weaknesses by not being able to afford to play Primeval Titans and Scapeshifts, but we're trying to shore those up by including diversity of threats.
Correct. The next section is we're going to talk about Scapeshift. Now we're just going to that. Before we do that, I do want to do a few shout outs. First one, make sure to check out Battle Bosses. It's the game we both designed. You can go look it up at battlebosses.com. It's a collectible figure game. You get a bunch of miniatures and you start upgrading them with cards. It plays a little bit like if Risk and Magic met with each other and had a child and then made that child play League of Legends. So check that out. It's really fun. The Kickstarter launch is August 14th. We're going to be previewing it at Comic-Con at GPLA. So that's the
the first week of the Kickstarter, and then at Gen Con, which is the first week of August. And you can check us out there if you're going to any of those events. If you're not going to those events, the Kickstarter is August 14th, and stuff will be available as time goes on. Go to battlebosses.com to put your email in to subscribe for more information, or like any of the pages that are on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
Yeah, we're
everywhere.
We're facebook.com/battlebossesgame.
Yep. So check that out. Make sure to also check out the Command Zone. They're our sister podcast. They do awesome Commander content. If you like Commander, they are the best place to go for any of that kind of stuff. I was on an episode a few weeks ago where we actually previewed a battle boss character, and they do game nights as well, which is one of the best shows about Magic out there. I was on the second episode, and I still get people who like I used to go to high school with or college with who like are just getting back into Magic, and they do it because they watch game nights, and then they're like, oh wait, I saw you, and it freaks them out because they're like, I know that guy. So that's cool, so check that out. And then last but not least, make sure to check out our Patreon. So we have a Patreon that is the way we're able to do this. It's the reason we were able to start accomplishing doing video every week. It's going to help us kind of get to the next steps and create more and more content. We can't do this without you guys. We definitely appreciate it. And if you check that out, we're patreon.com/themmcast. And now, let's talk about Scapeshift. This is a deck of choice. This is an interesting deck just in the history of Modern. You know, Valakut, which was the first deck that ever existed, which is when Primeval Titan and Valakut were in the format together, is possibly to be blamed partly for the Cobblade era. I mean, a lot of the kind of puff pieces of that time pointed out that Cobblade was dominant because it was so good against Valakut, and then Valakut was so good at destroying any deck that ever had a chance of being Cobblade that it just made it, like, Vengevine, a favorite card of mine, was printed to be an anti-Jace card, but because Valakut just wrecked any deck that tried playing Vengevines, there was just no chance for them to compete in the format. And so it kind of started out shutting stuff out, and then when they created Overextended and it rotated into that, when they shortened Extended to the four-year period, it became a dominant force there because you had Scapeshift finally, and you had Scapeshift and you had Prismatic Omen, and together with those two cards, it became a dominant force there as well.
And a lot of times people played Jace, which is where people got the idea for the Teemer Scapeshift decks, that people wanted to play Jace to help you find your pieces more quickly, and the mana bases in Extended at the time were just good enough to do that. You had Filter Lands and reflecting pools and such.
And so Modern was created, and they banned Valakut out the gate. It was one of the...
They didn't want Modern to be too similar to Extended.
Right.
They wanted people to be brewing new stuff at the beginning of the format.
That's why Bitter Blossom was banned. That's why Valakut was banned. That's why Jace was banned.
Dark Depths and...
Well, those weren't legal in Extended. Or that wasn't a deck in Extended.
In
Extended, it was a deck, but not in the four-year Extended.
Fair, but I think that one of the reasons those cards started out banned is because they had seen their power level in Extended, and they were like, let's have people do new stuff in Modern. Right. Sword of the Meek, which is now a card that got unbanned, made no waves. Sword of the Meek and Dark Depths were both banned at the start of the format because of their power level lifetime Extended, and they wanted you to be doing new things.
Yeah. And I mean, I've played Sword of the Meek combo in Legacy, and it's much more powerful there, but because you have stuff like Miracles going on that you can protect it. So, like, it made sense. So Valakut starts in the format banned. It's one of the first cards they ever unbanned. It was pretty quickly unbanned, and it was fine. Scapeshift became a deck. It's always been kind of where it is now, where it's a tier 2 deck. People were playing it in the Rug Shells, which is where they first kind of thought of playing it. And then the Delve spells were printed, and it became one of the best four decks in the format.
I was already playing Scapeshift. So my history with Scapeshift, it was the first Modern deck I ever built. Basically, I wanted to be playing Eternal Command. I was a fairly casual player at the time. Mm-hmm. I was playing like drafts, was like the most competitive thing that I was doing, but I wasn't really playing competitive Constructed.
Sure.
So when I thought of Constructed, I thought of it as more casual because I was like playing Commander and stuff. Right. So I saw Eternal Command on the World Championship stream. Shota Yasuoka was playing it against like the best players in the world, and he's like looping Cryptic Command with Eternal Witness. He's like viling in Eternal Witness to get back Cryptic Command, counter your spell, bounce my Eternal Witness, do it again next turn, you know, like Bolt, Snap, Bolt, mm-hmm. play Hunt Master, kill you. Like,
right.
The deck just seems super cool to me, but it used a lot of fetch lands because you were playing Tarmogoyf in the deck.
Right.
And you were playing Tarmogoyf. Yeah.
And, Tarmogoyf expensive at this point?
It was very expensive back then, yes. Yeah. Much more, actually, than it is now.
Yeah.
It was probably like $150 a piece or something. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to build that deck. So while I was putting the mana base together, I was on a budget, and so while I was putting the mana base together, I didn't have money for all the fetches, and I was like, well, Scapeshift is a deck that uses the same colors, it uses Snapcasters and Cryptics, but I don't need to pick up a playset of Calling Turns and a playset of Misty Rainforest just yet. I can work on that while I play the deck, right? Build up some store credit by playing in tournaments. And so I built Teemer Scapeshift, and at the time, Valakut had recently been unbanned, but there had been enough tournament results that people had realized it's not insane. And so the price of Scapeshifts was low. I've actually bought my Scapeshifts for $7 a piece.
Sure.
So I bought my Scapeshifts for $7 a piece. And I built the deck and I played it for a long time as Rug. And then when Bring the Light came out and that started getting popular, I had tried that out.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point, the metagame just kind of shifted where I wasn't really feeling it anymore. So I switched over to Grixis and sold my Scapeshifts for like $40 a piece.
Right. Well, I mean, Dig Through Time was a key piece of that deck. It got banned. It kind of fell out of favor and then
I forgot about Dig Through Time. So yeah, playing, I was already playing the deck when Dig Through Time came out and I was like, this is great.
Yeah.
My deck's the best.
Yeah, it was like Blue-Eyed Delver.
Blue-Red.
Blue-Red Delver.
With Young Pyromancer and stuff.
Yeah, with Young Pyromancer. It was the Jeskai Ascendancy decks. It was Birthing Pod, and it was Scapeshift. And those four decks kind of like just dominated for that time period.
Yeah, it was just tier one because those were the, well, barring Birthing Pod.
Yeah.
Birthing Pod was just broken.
Birthing Pod was just the best card in the format before and after.
And they got to play Deathrite Shaman. But those other decks were just the best Delve spell decks.
Right.
Jeskai Ascendancy and Delver were the best Treasure Cruise decks, and Scapeshift was the best Dig Through Time deck.
Right.
Because what I like about the blue versions of Scapeshift and what drew me to them is that they're basically a control deck with Scapeshift as your win condition.
Correct. Yeah.
So you're controlling the game. You're remanding their spells, buying yourself time. You're blocking with Sakura Tribe Elder and sacrificing it to buy time. You're lightning bolting their creatures. You're eventually you're cryptic commanding their spells, and Dig Through Time was just perfect because it drew you answers if you needed answers, and if you needed a win, drew you your win con.
And sometimes it drew you both.
Yep, you just dig through time. You're like, I'll grab a remand and a cryptic command. Thank you very much.
Or
a remand and a scape shift.
Yep.
Play scape shift. What do you got?
Normally nothing. Or just their own treasure cruise, and then they went off with Jeskai Ascendancy, and ooh.
Yeah, well, the remand and the cryptics helped a lot there.
So they banned, Valakut's back, it gets to be one of the top decks in the format, and then they banned Dig Through Time, knocking it back down, probably to tier 2, tier 3, and then it kind of exists, and then people start realizing at the same time that Bring the Light comes out. Bring the Light comes out, people are like, okay, now it's five color. But then at the same time, they're like, oh, we could just play red-green straight up, because at the same time, they printed the second red-green dual land in the format.
Cinderglade.
So Cinderglade and Bring the Light come out in the same set. We talked about this in last week's episode, where this is how Battle for Zendikar really affected Modern, is Scapeshift is one of the key pieces, because it split it into two decks. And red-green Scapeshift, Titan Shift decks have been a tier one deck in the format probably since then. And then
The early versions of Titan Shift were a lot of times playing through the breach with Emrakul,
mm-hmm.
Because it was a powerful combo that people had already been playing in Modern, and it seemed to fit well in the deck because through the breaching a Primeval Titan typically wins the game.
Yeah, it's really good.
People have dropped that nowadays. I think due to the speed of the format, I would guess.
I think it's just a consistent thing. If I'm able to cast this, I'm likely already able to cast Primeval Titan, or I won't have the pieces of Primeval Titan, so there's like five dead cards in my deck if I don't have Primeval Titan or Emrakul in my hand.
Yeah, I've never played Scapeshift without a ton of cantrips, so take my advice on Titan Shift with a little bit of a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think what it is just they realize these are dead cards, I'm already killing my opponent doing all the other things I'm doing, and I think Bloodbraid Elf just offered them that kind of aggressiveness that they needed while being more consistent of a card that drew them into the game plan they were already on.
Plus, because you're not drawing many cards in just the red-green deck, I mean, especially before Tireless Tracker, which this was, like, if you threw the breach in Primeval Titan and you, like, get two Valakuts and you're, like, ready to attack and kill them and they're, like, Path to Exile, now you've two for one to yourself and you probably don't have much left in hand.
Correct. So it definitely kind of, like, put you in a position where you would get close and then you would stall out versus now where I think they just add more powerful things to also be doing that help you out. The new lists are, you know, and then, but on the other end, bring to light decks, which are these five color monstrosities.
And that's what I did. It was the closest to what I was already playing. You still get to play Snapcaster and Cryptic Command and Remand
all
and
blue.
Like the blue core of the deck that drew me to it.
But now you also get to play stuff like Wrath of God, and you get to play stuff like Fatal Push, and you get to play stuff like, what's the thing that gets you an Empyrean?
Oh yes, Madcap Experiment out of the sideboard. So I was off the deck at this point, but I did a little bit of research before the episode and also just to check in on my old pet deck. And yeah, Madcap Experiment out of the sideboard seems really great. I had been playing three Inferno Titans in my sideboard, which took up a lot of space. Because post-board, in the blue version of Scapeshift, you're playing... you know, six or seven creatures. You're playing four Scourge Tribe Elders and like two or three Snapcasters.
Sure.
And that's the only creatures in your deck. So your opponent
creature removal is bad because Sacred Tribe Elders are terrible to try and point a removal spell at.
And if you want to remove my Snapcaster, that's fine. Yeah. I don't care. It already did its job, right? I mean, I'm not beating down with them in the deck because I'm dealing, you know, 20.
So for the record, I did actually also have this Scapeshift deck. I built it during the Dig Through Time era. It was the deck I moved to during that era. I like did that in Birthing Pod, and then both of them got banned out. It was a bad, sad time for me.
We kept playing Scapeshift. I did.
Yeah, I still have it built. It's still sleeved up. I never bought the fourth Scapeshift though, so I never took that to a tournament, but I was on my way, and then I slowed down. But Scapeshift was, you know, the amount of times I've beaten down my opponents with just Snapcaster Mage and Bolts, because Snapcaster Mage and Bolts can just do that.
Yeah, and you can tap their creatures with Cryptic. It's happened to me too, especially when they have Blood Moon and you're like, well, I could spend my time removing this Blood Moon or I could spend my time killing them.
Right.
But it's rare. I mean,
I can do like seven damage to you with the Snapcaster Mage by itself, and then you already dealt five damage to you because that's how this game works, and I'll just bolt and snap you for the rest of the game. It's just like a game plan I've done in my life.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that happens, and I've actually beaten people down with Sakura Tribe Elder too.
Oh, yeah.
Not from 20 to 0, but I've dealt six damage to them with the Sakura Tribe and the rest with the Snapcaster. Right.
One of the key things that you need to know with Scapeshift is that, you know, it doesn't, to get to higher than 20 actual damage takes an entire extra turn of effort, but you can do 18 damage pretty quickly. And
yes,
so
if you have seven lands in play, unless you're playing Prismatic Omen, which makes the math interesting, but I was not playing Prismatic Omen because I was a more controlling deck. I couldn't afford to draw dead cards like that. So, with seven lands, you get one Valakai and six mountains, and for each mountain you control, if you control five other mountains, which you do, because you've got six, then you deal...
Three damage.
Each mountain deals three.
So that's
then
18.
18.
And so it generally behooves you, especially if your opponents know what they're doing and are not fetching for, you know, doing damage or keeping themselves over 18, to attack with the Sacred Tribe.
Well, what's nice is if they're getting tapped lands, they're giving you so much time to just draw that extra land and then get two Valakuts and six mountains, at which point you deal 36 damage to them and they're super dead. You know, in matchups like Pod at the time, it was a big problem because they knew they needed to gain life and they had the tools to do it.
Yep.
So they would fetch shock, they would play all their cards on time, they'd pay life for Birthing Pod, but they're like, Kitchen Finks, sack Kitchen Finks to Birthing Pod, play Restoration Angel on Kitchen Finks, sack it to Birthing Pod again, and you're like, oh my God, what's your life total again?
Well,
and they're beating you up while they do
this.
And
they have spoons too, so they're just like, and I'm going to eat all the creatures I just killed. I love Birthing Pod. R.I.P. R.I.P. So that's kind of the Scapeshift. Before we kind of end the episode, what would you say right now in today's metagame are some of the... For Bring the Light Scapeshift, because that's the one that you have the most familiar with paying, and I think Red-Green Scapeshift is a little bit more cemented in the format anyways. What matchups are the worst for Bring the Light Scapeshift, and which ones do you think are the best of like the top-tier decks?
So I haven't played Scapeshift against the top-tier decks currently, so this is all conjecture based on my experience with the deck previously. So at the time, the biggest problem for the deck was Liliana, which luckily is not getting played nearly as much now. And in fact, Deathrite Shaman into turn two Liliana was literally unbeatable. I would just scoop it up. I mean, I'm not going to beat that. But because you're kind of a slower controlling deck, but you're also not playing many creatures, you don't really have a way to pressure Liliana. So she just pluses, pluses, pluses. You've got no hand. So like, what ends up happening is you either have to discard your counter spells, which leaves you vulnerable to just getting killed, or you have to discard your lands, and discarding your lands is just as bad because you have to hit seven if you're going to kill them. Or lands or ramp spells, which ramp spells are just lands that come into play quicker, right?
Yeah.
So Liliana was a big problem. So now I think the big problems for the deck are going to be like humans, because they have like similar disruptive elements like Thalia and Kitesail Freebooter that are like, and Meddling Mage, that are slowing you down and keeping you off your combo.
Oh yeah, I mean, a Meddling Mage,
into a Kitesail Freebooter or just another Meddling Mage seems unbeatable. Like, if you call Bolt and Scapeshift, I don't know.
That's unbeatable against a lot of decks. But I mean, humans, one of the things that makes it so powerful is, like, typically aggro decks have a poor matchup against combo decks because they're able to...
ignore you until the very last minute and then win out from under you.
Right. A lot of times the combo decks will be faster than the aggro decks, and the aggro decks, in order to be aggressive, are shaving disruptive elements like counterspells and thought seizes and things like that. And even if they have one counterspell or one thought seize, they don't have enough to stop you because you built a consistent combo deck, right? I mean, but humans is not that. Humans has all the disruptive elements right there, and they're all attacking you. So I could see that being a big problem for the deck. One thing that's nice is with Bring to Light, you're typically playing a lot of one-ofs, right? Mm-hmm. Both in the main and in the sideboard. So at the time that I was playing it, I had a Maelstrom Pulse, which can kill, you know, many Meddling Mages, or just one, which is probably what you need to do.
Right.
I was playing one Damnation, which is great. I was playing two Anger of the Gods, and then in the sideboard, I believe I had another Sweeper. I don't remember. It might have been a second Damnation.
Supreme Verdict?
No, I was not playing white. I was playing black was my other card.
Oh, okay.
And you'll draw the card sometimes, and if you draw a Damnation and it's just dead because you don't have black mana, it's rough. Yeah. Or it's Supreme Verdict and you don't have white. I am seeing some of the Bring to Light Scapeshifts playing white for Supreme Verdict because I think it's that much better than Damnation.
I also think it's a lot easier to cast one white mana off of a Supreme Verdict than it is to cast two black.
Supreme Verdict costs white, blue, one.
White, white, blue, one. Oh, you're right.
Yeah, it does.
Ignore me.
They typically make unconditional sweepers cost double color, so that you have to be committed to a color. Right. You can't just be splashing Wrath of God into whatever you want. So you already have the diversity of sweepers that you're seeing control decks playing now because they know that they need different sweepers to beat Meddling Mage because you can't just have them play Meddling Mage on Anger of the Gods. You lose. Haha. Like, you have to...
Is Path also just better in the Bring to Light decks than Fatal Push from the perspective that you can sometimes just path your own Snapcaster Mage to ramp?
That's true. That's very good, actually. Yeah. I can't say I didn't play it, but it sounds good.
Yeah.
Pathing your own Snapcaster is definitely something I would have been interested in.
Right. I mean, it just makes Snapcaster Mage into, like, the 5 through 8
and also exiling is very relevant in this.
Well, I mean, Path is obviously
this metagame of Culligan's commands and things.
I mean, I generally believe that Path is the best removal spell in Modern.
Yeah.
I mean, Bolt might be it, but like Bolt and Fatal Push definitely compete more, and Path just like, you need to kill something, it's dead. I mean, the problem is that white is not the best color, so you have that kind of dichotomy, and Path is the best white card in Modern history.
Yeah, so I think humans as like an aggro deck that specifically preys on combo decks would obviously be a problem because you are a combo deck and you need all these different cards to operate, and if they get Meddling Maged or Kitesail Freebooted or Thalia'd or whatever, then you're sad.
Right. Your deck is also all spells, so just having four Thalia's out in front of you is like...
Yeah, it's pretty annoying. And then... Another deck I could potentially see having problems with is Hollow One, because being a combo deck, those Goblin Lores and Burning Inquiries are going to be a big pain in your butt. Now, you can get lucky and beat them, for sure, because Sakura Tribe Elder is very good against Hollow One, because it does exactly what you need. You play it on turn 2, they probably have a Hollow One or Gurmag Angler or something ridiculous in play, but you just block it and sack, and then you get a land, and now you're ahead. You know, like, they haven't damaged you. Sakura Tribe Elder against Hollow One almost feels like Time Walk, I feel like. And that's great. But the problem is that you do need to assemble like some disruptive elements in order to stop them from winning. Mm-hmm. Because unlike Titan Shift, which is all in on ramp cards and Primeval Titan to just win as quickly as possible, you need a little bit more time. But you're playing Remands and Cryptics and Bolts and things like that to give you the time that you need.
Right.
Burning Inquiry can definitely like get rid of your disruptive elements, you draw a ramp, or it can get rid of your ramp, you draw all disruptive elements, but you can't play them fast enough. So I could see that deck being a problem just because of the random discards being a problem for combo decks.
Sure.
But other than that, I think against a lot of mid-range decks, Scapeshift's got game. The blue version in particular, because between Bring to Light and Blood Moon can be a bit of a problem because your mana base is kind of loose when you're playing four colors with a ton of mountains and Balakuts in your deck.
Yeah.
But you have Bring to Light and you have like other
We also like
main deck and sideboard options to beat a Blood Moon. And mm-hmm. if you can beat the Blood Moon, Mardu Pyromancer just doesn't present enough of a clock to beat you. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless they're playing like Liliana or something, which usually.
I even imagine like against blue-white-red decks, you have a little bit of a favored position because you are playing counter magic and you're like protecting your thing versus them just trying to stop you from doing
your thing.
Your
deck is good against control, yes.
And you just win the counter wars because you have all of the romance.
Yeah, especially post-board, you get like negates or swan songs or whatever your counter spells and your sideboard of choice are, dispels. And just being able to like have more mana is so relevant. Right. Like, you know, Mana Leak and Remand have fallen off, but that means all counter spells have fallen off, which is good for a slower deck like this. But I mean, at the time that I was playing it, Remand and Mana Leak were really good, and you were so good against them because you always have so much mana. You're like, oh, you remanded my Scape Shift? I'm going to play it again. Like, what do
Remand
you think?
Remand is insane against the Delve counter spell, so like...
Yeah, against Logic Knot.
Yeah, Logic Knot.
And you're
like,
playing Remands.
Yeah,
that's and it's insane. Great against Skirmag Angler too, actually. Yeah, and to an extent, Hollow One.
Yep.
You got to have it right then and there on turn two, and you have to not discard it. But
So I think that's kind of it for today's episode. Those are kind of your good and bad matchups. I want to thank everyone for listening on the live stream. Sorry for some of the difficulties we had at the beginning. You can check this episode with good recorded audio on YouTube at the end of this week. We're also releasing a bunch of other content on our YouTube channel, so check it out. And also check out the podcast app or collective.company to see these videos, but also the super secret Blue Black Dimir episode. That like,
oh, that's funny. It's a secret Dimir episode. I like that.
Yeah. So that was all
on
purpose.
It wasn't on purpose, though. I mean, was it?
Wait, maybe. All right. So, does it exist? We don't know. But yeah. So thanks for watching. Make sure to follow us. I'm at Cass Wiley.
You can find me on the Masters of Modern Facebook group is the best place to find me. But I'm around.
And we are at the MMCast. And make sure to check out Battle Bosses. Once again, we designed it. It's the best game that's coming out. You can buy it August 14th on Kickstarter. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.